Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. People have been using rhetorical tricks for years and years and centuries. And my guest on the Reset podcast today is Simon Lancaster. He's the author of the book Connect, How to Inspire, Influence and Energize Anyone, Anywhere, Anytime. And this book is for anyone that has to write, any book that has to be persuasive, and anyone that needs to talk in front of people. Simon goes through history, he looks at neuroscience, and he looks at how we remember things and how we connect with each other. I think you're going to like listening to Simon Lancaster. All right, Simon Lancaster, welcome to the Reset podcast. Now tell me, how do we reset how to connect with people?
I think the most important thing is just remembering that we're human beings. I think today, particularly for people in business, there's such this idea that your business is like a machine. We're always talking about driving change, accelerating reform. And it makes you think of us like nuts and bolts in a machine. And bottom line is, we're all human beings. You know, we all have the same needs. We all have pretty much the same kind of routines and habits, which is what you write about, obviously. And it's finding these points of connection. Just forget all of the bullshit. We're humans.
Yeah, right. And that's one of the things I really got about this, is that how to use language, and you use language superbly, by the way. You're just the way you can do a metaphor, and we're going to have a big chat about metaphors later, but the way you can get your language to flow in such a way and paint pictures, it does link to that uniquely human part about us, I think. And how do we help people do that? Say you're really worried about giving a speech. You're a speechwriter. We might actually start with a little bit. Yeah, tell the people who don't know you about you. Tell us the Simon Lancaster story.
Sure. So yeah, I'm a speechwriter, which makes it instantly sound like Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a speechwriter, and I first developed my habit back in the late 90s, working for ministers in Tony Blair's government. So I worked in political speechwriting for around about 8 years, and then I left. I got into business speechwriting. This was about the time that Obama was elected president, when all of a sudden everyone was Googling oratory and rhetoric, because obviously he was such an amazing practitioner of it. And so I launched my business, first ever speechwriting agency we'd had in London, and it instantly went boom. And I think within about 6 months of launching the business, I'd written speeches for the CEOs of no less than 5 FTSE 100 companies, so the biggest companies in Britain. And it was brilliant. You know, I think in politics, people had always taken their speeches very, very seriously. In politics, everyone knew it was make or break, whether or not you could give a good speech. In business, though, they'd spend like millions of quid getting their new website built or having a marketing strategy put into place. And then the CEO would be sent out to deliver a speech with literally like some scribbles on the back of a fag packet. And so, you know, it was my aim to help professionalize that and show them, look, just as you wouldn't get an amateur to build you a website, don't get an amateur writing your speeches. I think the standard has really lifted now. So you've got CEOs like really playing in to some big, big debates, whether it's kind of some of the, you know, the culture stuff that we're going through at the moment, the debate on climate change, all of these kinds of issues. CEOs are a bit more active participants than they were in the past, possibly.
What was it about Obama that sparked that? What was it about his style of rhetoric, his style of talking, that actually got people to get curious about that? What was it about Obama?
Well, what did you think about him? Did you like his stuff? What did he do for you?
Yeah, I love the way he pours so beautifully. He just uses the spaces between the words so eloquently, and he doesn't sound like he's ever rehearsed anything.
Yeah. You
know, and he has that sort of chocolatey voice that just sounds beautiful. And he just has this beautiful way to actually talk to the person that he's talking to without sounding like it's something that was written.
Yeah, so the thing about the pausing is really interesting, actually, because when you time speech, and as a speechwriter, you're always very aware how many words a minute someone speaks. And in usual conversation, we speak at about 220 words a minute. Barack Obama, about 90 words a minute. So he's so low. And it's not that he's speaking like this, which would be very annoying and patronizing, but rather instead, I mean, it is. We do have people who speak like that. John Bercow, our former Speaker of the House of Commons over here, had that kind of annoying, patronizing voice.
Well, but Tony Blair used to be quite annoying with that too. I used to hate the way Tony Blair would say two words and then say another two words. And you'd be like, just fucking tell me the sentence.
Yeah, I didn't think he was that. But I mean, you know, I'm a Blair
fan. You're probably
a bit
biased on that.
Yeah, my instinctive bias is kicking in there. I want to defend him now. But with Obama, I think that thing that he would speak in little blocks and just pause. And sometimes his pauses would be, and I've timed them, like 3.5 seconds. And for him, that would just be completely natural. Whereas in ordinary conversation, that would be so weird. And I think this may be the answer, or it may be one of the answers to the question you started with. What can we do to help us connect? I think Obama had such extraordinary confidence. And I think you can only pause for 3.5 seconds and you can only speak that deliberately if you feel an incredible self-confidence within you. And I think this is maybe one of the reasons why most business and corporate communication is so crap, that everyone goes into a meeting or a presentation or a speech so damn uptight, you know? Mm. And so, we see this all the time, don't we? You can have a perfectly animated and exciting conversation with someone over coffee, and then they say, oh, I'm giving a speech after the break, you'll see me up on stage, and then they go up and you're like, who are you? It's like someone has put a vacuum cleaner to their backside and, you know, hoovered out their soul and all of their emotion. You're
complete,
just like,
charisma bypass.
Yeah. And so I think this is a really important thing. So getting people to feel comfortable, which you can do in all sorts of ways. Of course, there's lots of relaxation techniques that you can Google and find out very, very easily. But I think most important is making sure that people really feel like they can be themselves when they're given a speech. They're not having to put on an act. They don't need to sound like a 19th century lawyer, you know, or a Roman orator to give a good speech. The best speech is when you feel good in yourself and you care about your audience and you know something about your subject.
Yeah. One of the things that I got from this book is to get, you made it really clear that you want to get your intent really clear. What am I trying to get across first? And I think sometimes we start with the words, but one of the things I got from reading Connect is that to start with your intent. What do I want to take someone from and to? And when you do that, I actually think it does set it up a little bit easier. How would you get people to get clear about their intent of what they want to get out of their speech?
Yeah, having a conversation with them and actually reading sometimes between the lines of what they say. If you are speaking with someone at business and you say, why are you giving this speech? What do you want to get out of this speech? And they say, well, it's to inform this stakeholder about our strategic plan until 2030. And it's like, you know, and it's kind of, you've got to dig a little bit deeper. And a lot of the time when people are giving speeches, what they really want to achieve from it, if they're honest, is having people admire them, having people like them, maybe get a promotion out of it. You know, if your chief marketing officer or if your chief commercial officer at a company, you know, probably you've got your eye on being CEO next. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, OK, so let's give a speech that shows you're a CEO. Let's give a speech that's get noticed. Let's start a debate. Let's get people really talking about what it is that you think. Let's get some ideas out there. So really finding out what their purpose is ever so important. If, you know, a speech feels aimless when you're sitting there in the audience, a lot of the time it's because it is literally aimless. The speaker has no aim. If you know why it is that you're doing it, I know with my thing, what I want to do, I always want to share techniques with people. I want to get across some techniques to people that can help them inspire, influence, energize anyone, anywhere, anytime. That's what I'm always trying to do. And sometimes, you know, you can forget why it is that you're doing stuff and just boom. And as long as you keep focus on your aim, then that's magic. Let me just my email off, Luke, because otherwise that's going to annoyingly ping. There we go. We're back. Right.
Go on. Yeah, because you actually used a few of those. You talk about giving people techniques and almost tricks that you can use. And you've got, I think there's five or six of them that you have. Can you share some of those? My favorite of yours is the three breathless sentences. Really hard to do, but when you do it, it sounds great. Can you tell everyone what some of these techniques are?
It does. So yeah, I'll talk you through. There are six techniques that you can use in a row to instantly prepare a super powerful speech. And you can create a super powerful speech on any topic whatsoever under the world. It can be the most absurd topic, and you can make a brilliant Obama-like speech. So there are six sequences, six tricks in sequence. Firstly, you start with three breathless sentences. Profits down. Markets in turmoil. Competitors on the move. Makes you sound urgent, like you're hyperventilating. Trick number two, three repetitive sentences where you repeat the opening clause in three successive sentences. We've got to change the way that we work as a business. We've got to change the way we market ourselves as a business. And we've got to change the way that we think as a business. This creates urgency. It sounds like you're fixated on a particular idea. Technique number three, three balancing or contrasting sentences. We're looking to the future, not the past. Working together, not against one another. Thinking about what we can do, not what we can't. This makes you sound like you're weighing something up. On the one hand this, on the other hand that. So it sounds like balanced good thought. Technique number four is metaphor. When you say something is something which it is not. So this plants an image in people's mind, an image that you hope will become embedded and blossom and grow. But you don't want to get carried away with your metaphor. If you can taste sick in your mouth while you're saying it, you've gone too far. And you need to save it for technique number five, which is your three exaggerative sentences. We're working night and day, giving our heart and soul, and we'll throw everything that we've got at this problem. This shows your personal commitment and conviction to it. And then six, you end with a rhyme, because rhyme is sublime and rhyme works every time. A rhyme doesn't cost a dime. And if it rhymes, it chimes. So that wow. is your set. It's beauty. And you can get someone who's got no knowledge of rhetoric or speech writing. Give them those techniques within 15 minutes. They'll create a speech on a topic of their choosing and be like, wow, fucking hell.
That was awesome.
Yeah, they really will. I mean, if you want to give me a topic now, Luke, give me a topic that, go on, and I'll improv a speech using the...
Okay, let's have a look around my desktop. Yoda is the king of philosophy.
Yoda is the king of philosophy. Okay. Great experience. Great thought, great wisdom. We shouldn't be listening to idiot politicians like Boris Johnson. We shouldn't be listening to disgraceful billionaires like Elon Musk. We shouldn't be listening to faux gurus like, I won't name any. Instead of turning to false prophets, we should be listening to great wisdom of the past. Wisdom not that you find in conventional wisdoms, but instead a newer, more beautiful form. An idea that is set not in any factual basis, but from fiction. I am talking, of course, about the ultimate skyscraper, towering movie that towers over all others. I'm talking about the wisdom we get from Star Wars. And Yoda must have been the greatest ever thinker in the whole of history. And he had wisdom to enable you to navigate your way through the most thorny of dilemmas, to be able to show you light in the darkness, to be able to break free from any ties that are holding you back, to be able to see through to the heart of any kind of problem. So I tell you what, and I say this even in the morning where I have a slightly red eye, that if you want to succeed, you want to turn Jedi.
Love it. That is awesome. For all you Star Wars heads out there, that one was especially for you. But you can, I can, it's really, it's amazing when you've read this book, and it's an amazing book, Connect by Simon Lancaster. This book, you see it in a lot of places, and you see it when it's done well, and you also can see when it's done poorly. When people start using four and five of those repetitive sentences, it sounds terrible. They use three and it sounds great. There's a real sort of happy medium, isn't there?
Yeah, and you see it all over the place as well. So it's not just in speeches. Once you've got the hang of these techniques, you see it in advertising copy, you see it in newspaper editorials, you see it in adverts, you see it in the text on the back of your cereal box. You know, you're never... You see the world in a completely different eyes. And the amazing thing to me always is Luke, that these techniques, they're not new. They have been around literally for thousands of years. Mm. You know, all of these techniques were written about in ancient Rome and ancient Greece, things like the power of threes, the power of repetition, exaggeration, all of those techniques that I just used in that little riff. All of them are 2,000 plus years old. And it always seems to me amazing that we don't learn this stuff at school. You know, it was only after I'd been a professional speechwriter for about 3 or 4 years that my wife's uncle, who's a classicist, he said to me, oh, if you want to really understand how to be a speechwriter, you've got to read Aristotle,
Socrates,
Cicero, Quintilian. Yeah. And he set me off on this path. And then I was like, why didn't anyone tell me this before? Why didn't anyone tell me this before? And it was like I'd unlocked a whole new world, and I started seeing language in a completely different way. And there are so many of these techniques. Those six techniques that I've just given you there, they're the best ones. I mean, I'm in no doubt. They are the best ones. If you learn those, you're straight away going to be in the top 5%.
And you don't necessarily have to do all six either. You don't have to do all six of them. So even if you can just have two or three of them that you can go to, you know, not everyone can rattle off what you just did before about Yoda, but you can definitely, you know, find three contrasts and you can have three breathless sentences. That's actually quite easy. There's another rule of three that you used when you're doing a speech or something like that. And it was the three of my story, our story, and what's next. Can you take us through how that works? Because that's a beautiful way to structure a speech, isn't it?
I love that so much. So, yeah, if you're ever asked to give a speech and you've not been given notice, which happens from time to time, you know, you're at a party, someone's leaving party, and if you're the boss, someone will just come over and say, oh, you wouldn't mind saying a few words, would you? And you're like, oh, shit, you know, what do I say? And it's just having this structure in the back of your mind, my story, our story, what next? Just it gives you an instant framework that you can use. So the my story is basically, well, you know, what brought me here today? And that might be a story if it's a leaving party. You know, I'll never forget when I first met, you know, Jeremy, and he came in and just share what your first impressions were and how he seemed like a jerk or how he started to amaze you or something. And then, so that's the my story. Then you move into the our story and start pulling out some of the people in the room. Like, you know, and I remember so-and-so said this and so-and-so said that, and reminding people of your shared values, shared experiences, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And then you end with the what next? Just look into the future. And this is an off-the-shelf framework, but it's one that's used by so many great, great speakers around the world. You know, this is basically the formula that Barack Obama used in 2004 in his big speech to the DNC, the one that threw him in public attention. It's used by people like Oprah Winfrey, Meghan Markle, actually, in her speech to the United Nations, all sorts of great people. And it works like magic. I do this one with most of my business clients as well. And so if they'll come to me and say, they'll say, I've got to make a speech like inspiring people about how we've got to change as a business, just really generic theme like that. And so then I'll say to them, I'll find their my story. And I'll say, well, when was it? Go back in your life. I'll get them to kind of relax a bit and think back through their life. And like, when was the first time in your life that you realized the importance of change? You know, and then they might come up with a story about, it could be a story about their parents divorcing. You know, it could be quite a sad story. It could be a story about them getting married. It could be a story about them changing school when they were young or going to university for the first time. It's always unique, but it's like their story about why change is so important. And then they start with that, and straight away they've got the audience like in the palm of their hands. Mm. That instead of being a big CEO, like they're waving a finger at them saying, you've got to change. I'm changing your jobs and all of this, which will instantly put them on the defensive and on the back foot. Rather, instead, you start with your story that makes you instantly relatable, identifiable, makes you much more appealing. And then you move your way forward like that. And I mean, literally over the last week, I've worked this through with a couple of clients that I'm writing speeches for at the moment. They know it's a template, but it's a bloody good one. Yeah. And it's like if you're a songwriter, you know, why would you do anything other than go verse, chorus, middle eight, yeah, chorus to fade? Yeah. If there's a template that you know works, mm-hmm, use it.
Yeah, love it. Love it. And some of these stories that you tell in that, and the finding the template, I think, is really important, like you're talking about there. But one that really got me thinking, and I haven't mastered it yet, and I think it's going to take a long time to master, is picking the right metaphor. I'd never thought about the subtleties of metaphors, how some of them are about journeys and some of them are about war and conflict and stuff. And how do we go about finding the right metaphor? Because the book, you explain this beautifully. I'd love you to explain to the audiences how we do that.
Yeah, metaphor is far and away the most powerful piece of political communication or persuasive communication. And yet it's not something that we ever really talk about. A lot of the time when we use metaphor, we use them unconsciously, and we use it a hell of a lot of the time. On average, we use metaphor once every 16 words. Great. So it's hard to speak for long without reaching for a metaphor. And, you know, metaphors are very loaded. Pew! Metaphors plant ideas in people's minds.
Well, even just the sentence, reaching for a metaphor, that's a metaphor.
Indeed. Yeah, and you're creating an image in people's minds when you do that. So, that creates certain associations and therefore certain feelings. So if I'm talking about how a metaphor is very loaded, then that is, I'm saying a metaphor is like a gun. So if you're involved in very combative communication, you feel like you're under attack, that might make a metaphor very appealing to you. So if I'm talking to lawyers love that metaphor. You know, they're like, yeah, you know, it means I'll be able to shoot my opponent's argument down. It's explosive. And I'll then really lean into it. I'll say, yeah, damn right. It's a metaphor is the nuclear weapon of communication. I'll really, it will obliterate your opponent's argument. And they're like, yeah, bring it on, you know. Whereas if people are a bit more, you know, if you're a coach or you're looking to get the best out of people, then that metaphor is not going to be good. You don't want to be shooting down your clients when they come in. So instead, a coach might prefer a metaphor about how it plants ideas in people's mind. A metaphor plants ideas. So very different images, you see. You can speak about a metaphor as a seed and a plant, or you speak about it as a gun. And your choice of metaphor is fundamental to the way that people will then behave. So there have been heaps of studies showing how metaphor, just changing metaphor in a piece of text, leads people to fundamentally different conclusions on issues ranging from whether they'll invest in companies, support policies, even back a foreign war. So that is the power of metaphor. So it really is the nuclear weapon of communication. It's so powerful. When I'm trying to find metaphors, I'm like listening to how people speak and seeing where they come from in life. And I remember, Luke, something unusual about you is that you used to live in Crawley of all places, and you worked in Specsavers, didn't you?
I did.
You worked in
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you see there, if I was talking about a metaphor, I might talk about how a metaphor gives you a new perspective, how it gives you a new lens on the world, how it changes the way people see things, how you can change the optics on things.
Changes what you focus on, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So using that kind of the visual metaphor, because you're bound to have all sorts of stories from working in Specsavers about how people see things. And, well, metaphors determine how people see things. So that would be a metaphor that I'm using specifically for you. But yeah, I mean, metaphor is so powerful. And just taking the big issues we're talking about in the world today with climate change, if you speak about climate change as a race against time, which is the way the United Nations talk about it, or you talk about how we've got to combat climate change, you know, which is how King Charles is now talks about it. Or if you talk about our house is on fire, like Greta Thunberg talks about it, these fundamentally different metaphors will then lead people to perceive very different levels of urgency. The race metaphor is, you know, it's a race. It's for fun. It's competitive. You know, it's very different to talking about our house is on fire. Our house is on fire, Greta Thunberg. That's emergency. You've got to act now. You've got to get the hell out. You've got to get the hell out right now. And so getting your metaphors right, which is, you know, is fun. It's creative. And, you know, you write about curiosity and all of that and explore these things. And sometimes just playing with different metaphors is a great way to unlock new lines of thought. Like think about your business. If you think about your business as a treasure chest, or you think about your business as a car, or you think about your business as a tree, think about your business as a game. You can explore these different connections and they lead you to fundamentally different ideas and perspectives, which can then give breakthroughs in thoughts. You know, Aristotle said to be a master of metaphor was a sign of genius. Mm-hmm. And when you think about people like Churchill, Iron Curtain, or James Watson, the building blocks of DNA, or Adam Smith, the invisible hand of the market, you can see this is right, that ability to see things as things that they are probably is the sign of genius. Although by that measure, Donald Trump is probably also a genius because of Drain the Swamp. He was also rich in metaphor.
You told two stories that had really shit metaphors. Or basically metaphors about shit. One was the shit sandwich and the poo in the pool. Now tell me why the shit sandwich is no good, and I'd love you to tell us the whole story about the poo in the pool, because I love this one.
Yeah, I mean, shit is a metaphor that every single person on the planet understands. And so, you know, this because I write for global CEOs, you do want to find things that are going to connect with people in Arabic, in Cantonese, in whatever language around the world. And to be a human being, you understand that shit is something disgusting that you must stay away from. Every animal, indeed, understands that. Mm-hmm. And so, shit metaphors work very well. And so I remember
shit
when...
Because people do that shit sandwich when they're talking about feedback, don't they? They kind of, I'm going to put a compliment and then put the feedback about what you shit at, and then I'll give you another compliment. And you talked about in the book how that's got a ratio of 2-1 of positive to negative, but 2-1's not enough, apparently.
Yeah, so studies on conversation indicate instead that what you need is a 5-1 ratio of positive to negative comments. And even then, I would challenge that. I find that no one likes eating shit, whether it comes in a ratio of 2-1 or 5-1. Do you know what I mean? If you say to someone, come round to my house for dinner, and I'm going to eat lobster and prawns and,
five,
you know, lovely
things and some shit.
Yeah, and all of these. And then we're going to finish with some shit. You know, well, no one ever wants to eat shit. So, I mean, I think even, you know, I don't think any shit is that you've always got to frame everything in a positive way, I think, which is always possible to do. It's like, are you sacking someone or are you setting someone free? Yeah. You know, there are always different ways to frame things. You can always flip things around positively. The other thing with the shit sandwich is people can now fucking see the shit sandwich coming. Yeah, they're from the other end of the M4. You can see it coming. So you're like, Luke, you've been doing really, really brilliantly in this pod. You can feel it coming. You're like, TikTok, you know. And so people see it coming. So instead, I mean, I always would just go for a model of like kind of, you know, flattery, you know, humility, remind of shared values, remind of shared purpose, and then the ask, what you're asking them to change, you frame in a positive kind of way. And that is much more likely to be able to get people to do what you want rather than the just, I've just been served a shit sandwich.
And the shit sandwich is gonna ruin culture. And so will a poo in the pool. Tell everyone that story, because I love this story.
Yeah, the poo in the pool is a fun one. It's been around for a few years actually, but it's this idea. So you say to people, like, right, I want you to imagine that we've gone on holiday somewhere gorgeous, like we're in Miami right now, and we're all there. We're by the pool, the sun's shining, we can all feel the warmth of the sun on our skin, and we're sitting around and we've had a couple of cocktails, and you know, we're having a laugh together. And then I say, why don't we all get in the pool and we all have a nice swim? And then one of the team points to the pool and says, someone's crapped in the pool, there's poo in the pool, we can't go in there. And so I go there and I get the net and I pull one of the poos out, and there's still three in there, and I say, go on, we can go in now. And people are still pointing at it, so we don't want to go in there, there's three poos in the pool. So I pull out another one of the poos, so there's just two in there. And again, people are saying, I don't want to go in there because there's poo in the pool. And so when this is used, it's used as a metaphor, basically, for the difficult bastards, the awkward bastards that you find in every single workplace, the people that are kind of making the culture shitty. And if you've got people like that, no one wants to be creative. No one wants to have fun. No one wants to innovate. And so this is a funny metaphor. It like makes people smile. It makes people smile for a few reasons. Firstly, because they're imagining being in Miami, drinking cocktails and being in the sun, but also because it's funny talking about poo. Poo is always quite funny when it's mentioned, particularly if you're British and you have a puerile sense of humour like I do. But also it's making a very powerful point, you know, which is forcing people to think, am I the poo in a pool?
Yeah.
Am I do I create a stinky culture for everyone else? And so I've seen it done a couple of times, and it's... It forces people to think. It forces people to see people differently, as you might say, if you've worked in Specsavers in Crawley.
There you go. But it's almost like just the no dickhead policy, isn't it? We're going to have a no dickhead. There's no poos in the pool here. So if you're being,
yeah,
step out of it. But even little thing that you told another story about they were restructuring a certain company, and they knew it was going to be hard, and they actually named the thing they were going to do Project Kylie.
Which, yeah, after Kylie Jenner. Yeah. Not Kylie Jenner.
Why does that work so well?
Yeah, well, I think it's thinking about the association. So we know, and you write about this in your brilliant book as well, we know the way our brain works, that we've got all of these billions of neurons that I know you and I have both counted, and we both arrived at the same number, 86 billion neurons, and they're capable of making all of these connections between them. And it's like, if you say we're going to have an organizational change, instantly in a company, for most people, that is going to spark associations with previous organizational changes, which no doubt led to people's jobs being moved, you know, but some people losing their job.
It maybe sparks fear, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sparks fear and therefore resistance. And so it's about making sure that when you announce this, you do so in a way that creates positive connections in people's minds. So this was a guy called Pete Pritchard, who was the CEO of Pets at Home, a big retailer here in the UK. He did this big organizational change and he called it Project Kylie. Brilliant. So straight away, instead of thinking about we're going to lose our jobs, you're imagining gorgeous Kylie Minogue, you know, undoubtedly Australia's greatest export ever. And instead of thinking about organisational change and fear, instead we're thinking about her cute little butt in those wonderful golden hot pants. And we're hearing spinning around, you know, and we're thinking all we're about neighbours, you know, absolutely brilliant. But a lot of my clients, I think about these kind of connections, you know, so connecting with great people from history, great people that they really, really admire. One of my other clients is a Brazilian CEO, and he loves Pelé. And so he'll always talk about Pelé is his Yoda, basically.
Yeah.
Whenever he's looking for inspiration for the right thing to do in life, he's like, what would Pelé do? What would Pelé say? Mm-hmm. And so he always starts off like that. So you're then starting. It's like a springboard story. You start with these ideas of glamour, wealth, success, all of this, and then you launch into the organizational change. So you're just starting it from a positive footing. And then you've got people smiling and nodding from the beginning, rather than if you start saying, today I'm going to talk about organizational change, why we have to change, how we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. If you start like that, people are instantly like, whereas if you start with a story, you start with a story about Kylie or Pelé, people are like, whoa, tell me more. This sounds good.
Yeah. And I love the one of the things you do towards the end is you get really clear about what's the most important thing to you. And this kind of freaked me out a little bit. You said before, what would Pelé do? All right. Mm-hmm. And I have a process I do that anyone that's been to any of my workshops, it's called Finding Carlos. And Finding Carlos is the better version of me. And the better version of me is curious, creative, and generous. So being curious, being creative, and being generous is really important to me. And it freaked me out a little bit when I read your book, because you put three words down that were most important to you. And it was creative, curious, and connecting, which I think connecting and generous can probably interchange. And
No way. I'm not generous. I'm not generous at all.
I'm sure you are. You're always generous with your time with me anyway. But there's something really cool, I think, about being able to – it's almost like when we want to connect with people, we've got to be clear about our intent. And if we want to show up and be really clear about who we're going to show up as, then I think that can actually make that a little bit easier. And I want to – one of the things I notice when people – you see people about to talk from stage, if they're getting really nervous, one of the things I like to go up to them and say is, like, are you here to help these people? Are you here to serve them? Are you here to make their life better? I just used three repetitive sentences then. And whenever they do that, they actually can turn up and they're okay. They actually get up on stage and they're all right, because if they're concentrating on how they're serving, it actually makes it a lot easier as well.
Yeah, but that's brilliant. I mean, that's great. It works on a number of different levels, that I'm sure, that approach though, Luke. So if they're getting all introspective, and, you know, they're thinking about, oh, God, I'm going to be awful, I'm going to be terrible and all of that, then getting them to think about why they're there to serve people, that gets them out of their own head and thinking about people in the room. So genius. I have a few different exercises that I do with my clients to find out what their three are. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll show them a long list of words, which will be words like curiosity, creativity, courage, compassion, honesty, humility, like literally like about 80 of those different words. And I'll ask them to say, what are their top three? And then I'll ask them why they're so important. You know, so why is curiosity so important to you? Why is creativity so important? Why is generosity? And I'll get them to go back through their life, you know, and literally, when was the moment that you realized generosity was so important? And again, this then gets people telling me the most amazing stories. Like, why is generosity so important to you? I did this with a client like the other day, and she took me right back to, she had a really clear memory of Christmas Day when she was about 5 years old, and her parents used to always invite round to her house anyone in the local community who didn't have anywhere else to go. And, and literally her dad was like running a taxi service on Christmas morning, going out and, you know,
finding collecting. Orphans.
Yeah. Finding and Christmas she described, orphans. Oh, but it was so moving the way she described it. She was like saying there was a woman there who was obviously very clever. And the story was she'd been to Oxford or something, but she'd had then had a terrible nervous breakdown, which meant that she was unable to connect with people. And she'd come round on Christmas Day. She'd just sit there quiet, wouldn't speak, but she'd be smiling. She'd be nodding along, but she would never say anything herself. And then she described this other man at the far end of the table. And she was like, now I think about it, he was probably an alcoholic. Cause my mum was always like, make sure the bottle of wine doesn't wind up at that end of the table. And she had the, but this was like, and this was why generosity mattered to her. So this was then motivating the decisions that she's taken as a leader today. And it's that getting in touch with why. So whether it's finding Carlos or finding your best self, however, or just showing up, you know, that kind of connection with who we are and what really matters to us is so important, and getting people to connect with that, because there's so much bullshit that everyone has to do at work, you know, stuff that they probably don't really care about. And connecting with these stories that have really shaped who we are as individuals, our origin stories, if you like, they help us find that source of energy and tap into that energy that brings us to life, which is so important.
It does. And that, and I think that's what this book does. It gives you a few frameworks to be able to sort of say, okay, this is who I want to be. This is how I want to show up. This is how I want to help. Here's some tools so that you can do that much more easily. The book's called Connect, How to Inspire, Influence and Energize Anyone, Anywhere, Anytime. Simon Lancaster, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, mate. It's been fantastic, and thanks for coming on the Reset podcast.
I've really enjoyed it, Luke. Do you know what? You're pretty good at inspiring, influencing and energizing people yourself, aren't you? I feel really inspired, influenced and energized after our chat. So thanks ever so much for having me on. And, you know, all the best with your book, and all the best down under. And yeah.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Reset podcast with Simon Lancaster. If you'd like to get his book, Connect, you can get it from Amazon or Booktopia or any good bookstores. If you'd like to get my new book, Curious Habits, you can get that from the same place. I'm Luke Mathers, and it's been fun talking resets with you. Bye.